Welcome to podcast number 27 of My Favorite Detective Stories. Today's date is November 26, 2018, and I'm your host, John A. Hoda. Our guest this week is John F. Nardizzi. He is the owner of the Boston-based Nardizzi & Associates private investigations firm. He is a pioneer in investigating wrongful convictions and developing information on decades-old cases. He has published articles for Pursuit Magazine, PI Magazine, Lawyers Weekly, and writes and speaks frequently about the investigations industry. Nardizzi is admitted to the State Bar of California as well as the federal courts of the Ninth Circuit. As a leader in the high-end investigation market, he formed a private investigation firm to provide the best investigative services possible, elite ethical services without the bureaucracy of a large security firm. He's also the author of the crime thriller Telegraph Hill and has two more novels in the works. Welcome, my friend, John F. Nardizzi, to the show. My Favorite Detective Stories podcast features past or present detectives and investigative journalists. As a working investigator of over 42 years, I hope to inform, inspire, and entertain you with great stories. We want to learn from our guests how they got started in the field and why they decided to become investigators in the first place. Listen as they tell us about the early years and who were their mentors and why those mentors had such a huge impact on their careers. We'll explore what makes for a good investigator and what makes for good investigation. But most importantly, after you get to know our guests, we will ask them for their favorite detective story, or maybe two. Stay tuned. The interview is about to begin. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Hey, John. Great to be here.
So, how are things in Beantown today?
Things are excellent. Catching up on some lost sleep through the October World Series, so we were up late for a lot of those games.
That's right. Putting the wood to those Los Angeles Dodgers out there in L.A., right?
Oh, exactly.
So, yes, I'll say that the Red Sox won the World Series this year, and congratulations. And I see that your Patriots are off to another great start, too, as well.
They are. Yeah, it's been a fortunate year so far up here in Boston sports.
Yes, and the Celtics are representing themselves well as well. Now, have the Bruins started their season, or are they still in preseason?
I think they're into it, but I'm not much of a hockey fan, so okay. I'm gonna avoid that topic.
Okay, no problem. So as we record this, it's Friday, November 9th, 2018. And, John, I've known you for, I don't know how many years now, and we have some common interests. We can talk about our work and our hobbies forever, but maybe we should just let the listeners in on this. So what I always ask all of my guests when they come on is, when people ask you what you do, what do you tell them?
I used to joke with people that I look into people's eyes and tell when they're lying, but that doesn't really make everybody comfortable. So I think most people, I just tell them that I'm a private investigator and I work on business fraud and litigation cases. Okay. And most of my clients are law firms, so that's kind of my sweet spot. And I think most people have an image of investigators, and they're usually sort of curious about it, and you can kind of play for and against the stereotypes, because I think what we do is often very different than what people think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, for sure. And, thinking that we have some magic plays both ways. I think sometimes it keeps people interested in what we do, but also it makes for unrealistic expectations. I think that's a fair way of saying it.
Yeah, definitely.
But then also private investigators also, I think, can sometimes be their own worst enemies by playing in a stereotype and giving us a black eye with, some real knuckle-dragging, thug-like activity. And it only takes a few to tarnish the entire profession. So,
yeah. For real. And I think the one thing, and you and I have talked about this a lot because we do very similar kinds of work, is people are always surprised by how good businesses and good law firms use investigators to interview witnesses. And that includes everything from locating them to preparing them for a trial to interviewing them informally. That's the single biggest thing that we do, and that we get paid well for, And I think that's in some ways, it's almost like becoming a little bit of a lost art, I sometimes think. You know, everybody thinks that, oh, you just jump on a database and do your work on databases, people sitting, you know, at their desk all day. It's not what the job is.
No, not at all. And the fact that you still see the craft of interviewing as being important, you know, warms my soul, too, because I see that as being my most single important asset that I bring to my clients, is that I'm good in the neighborhoods. And
exactly, and
I get to knock on doors and I get to talk to people and I get to obtain information that other investigators may not be able to. And
yeah,
if that's a market differentiator for me, I'll take it. But it's also,
and we talk to strangers about difficult subjects. That's if you can do that, you know, that is a absolute key skill that is really never going to diminish. You know, everybody, good law firms need that. They recognize it. They'll pay you well if you can do it. So,
and a lot of times that one interview is all you get.
Yeah.
So that has to be the interviewer, us, have to be really on our game and have to be prepared for that. It's just not getting out of your car, shuffling through your papers, hoping that you can pronounce the guy's name right when you knock on the door. It's a lot of preparation goes into that, because you only get that one shot sometimes. You only get that one bite of the apple, as they say.
Yeah.
So anyhow, so how was it that you got started in this business?
Well, it was funny. I was in law school in California, and you know, you remember certain days in your life as being very formative, you know, the day you met your wife and the day your children are born. And, you know, this, I went to a conference that was held on a Saturday morning, and the topic was, you know, other careers that lawyers had gone into. And there was a panel of different people, and two of them were entirely unremarkable, and I don't even remember what they talked about. Mm-hmm. But the third guy was a lawyer who had become a private investigator, and he basically described the job as an investigative reporter who is not writing, you know, for the Wall Street Journal or a newspaper, but he's writing for an audience of maybe, you know, 5 to 10 trial lawyers, and some of the cases go on for years and years. And you go out there and you travel and you look for, you know, you've done research, you've found potential witnesses, and you go out and you interview them. And, you know, it really set a light off in my brain. I just thought, well, you know, this combines my interests in law with my interests in writing, my interest in reporting. I had always thought about becoming a reporter, but had never really pursued it. So that was a big change in my direction, and I ended up harassing the private investigator for about a year until he finally consented to meet with me.
No kidding.
Which.
Now, did that meeting result in employment or just a discussion about getting into the profession?
It actually did. So what happened was he hung around for a long time afterwards, talking to maybe 3 or 4 people, me included, that were very interested in it. And then I this was, you know, way before cell phones, and you know, I would call his office every couple of weeks and leave a message, and I would try different approaches. As, hey, you know, we should go out for dinner. He was an Italian guy. I'd say, you know, we'll go out for a nice Italian meal downtown San Francisco. I would suggest coffee in the morning. And his secretary one time called me, and she said, you know, he gets a kick out of you because you keep calling. You're never deterred by the fact that he hasn't called you back once in 53 times that you've called. And you're very polite, and you try something different every time. And she said, he actually said, I think I may be able to use him in a case in a few weeks. So sure enough, he ended up calling me and hired me sort of part-time. So my last year in law school, I actually worked probably about 20 hours a week for this PI firm while I was wrapping up my law school career.
No kidding. And do you mind saying what town that was in, just generally?
Yeah, that was San Francisco.
No kidding.
I was going to the University of California, Hastings, where I graduated law school, and then I worked for a firm called Palladino and Sutherland in San Francisco.
Oh my Lord, that is so coincidental. I just interviewed David Corbett.
Oh really? Yeah.
A short while ago, he's an alumni from Palladino and Sutherland too, as well.
That's right. And I used to He was just before me. I would see his name on documents on occasion, on, you know, witness interview reports. So, yeah, I don't know him well. But, okay.
But he's also a writer.
He is, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's so strange. Well, you know what? I got to tell you then, Palladino had an eye for talent, because I know I now know you now. I just met Dave a couple weeks ago. And he definitely, not Dave, I'm saying Palladino definitely knew that you had that special sauce. So, and to that point, I'd like to ask you, you know, was there any training involved with that business, or how did they get you started? How did they get you out there on the street?
You know, it was interesting. I mean, it wasn't, you were sort of thrown into the mixer a little bit. You were expected, you know, working for that firm was not for the faint of heart. Palladino himself was a kind of an old school boss, you know, yelled at people all the time. Some people, I think, found it intimidating. Mm-hmm. I grew up with an Italian house with a father who was very almost the same age, who had the same tactics. So it sort of was old hat for me, and I would just yell back at the guy. really, I mean, I that's basically why I got hired. So not that I recommend that as a typical job search tool, but you were kind of thrown into it. You know, within probably a week, I was in Seattle working on a case and was, you know, you were judged on results. Like, could you go out there and find these witnesses and interview them? If they did not talk to you, it probably meant that you weren't cut out for that kind of work.
Yeah.
And I did have great coworkers, people like Michael Weber, Mimi Brubeck, Ellen McGarahan. Some of them were trained as journalists and reporters, especially Ellen was a Miami Herald reporter. So I learned a lot from them, you know, talking to them about how to write interview reports and things like that. So, but it was kind of up to you to get trained, mm-hmm. you know, it wasn't really formal.
And it seems like there were some mentors there, people that would help you. But it would also mean that John had to fall on his face and get back up again and not make that mistake again and learn from that mistake. And it was by learning from those mistakes that you got better and better and better at your craft. Is that a good way of saying it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I know that not everybody, you know, I don't know if that's a great way to train a staff, but that was, you know, you were sort of sink or swim. That was the message.
And, and the point is, or get out of the lake. So I'm using the lake. I know you're in San Francisco, so I could have used the bay. I'm sorry. but the point being that was, like you said, not for the faint of heart. That if you couldn't accept self-criticism and self-correction, and you wanted to go to some place where they would hold your hand through everything and do it nice and easy, and then you would gradually be brought into it, I doubt that you would have had the same learning curve as you had. I mean,
absolutely, yeah. And the one message that was delivered over and over, and everybody understood this, and everybody was into it, was, you know, nothing would be accepted other than the most driven, excellent work product. I mean, you were, you know, you had to rewrite these reports until they were perfect. And, you know, I've carried that on. I mean, I think to this day, sometimes lawyers will say, hey, you know, that report that you wrote, I'll never forget it. It was just, you know, it solved so many problems for us. We were prepared for that witness. Everything was accurate once we actually got them on the stand. Mm. So that final written report, to me, is what really separates sometimes the top firms from just average. Because I think, you know, it's going to be relied on by trial lawyers. They're very demanding,
mm-hmm.
and it's going to be tested. I mean, if you say that the witness said A, B, and C, and then they call them and they back off all that stuff, it calls into question how good were you really accurate in what you were writing, or did you really have a rapport with that witness? So,
or were you making it up?
Yeah. Yeah. Did you make mistakes? Did you just fabricate stuff? So
sure.
You got to be really careful with those interview reports.
Well, it seems like some of your early mentors there were also, like you said, journalists and reporters. So they had their stock in trade. They know how to put words on paper under deadlines based upon investigations they were doing. So.
And the deadline thing is key, because, you know, reporters especially, just they know you can't, you know, you got to get this thing in by 8 o'clock in the morning. That's it. You know, there's not going to be any leeway there. Things going to press, and private investigators are very similar. You have a trial and the witness is on tomorrow. If you interview them the night before, that's it. You just have a short period of time to get that information to the lawyer.
Absolutely, for real. So, I mean, early in your career, you began to see the difference between maybe some of your competent investigations and then ones that really sparkled. What do you think was the difference between, you know, stuff that would just, you know, pass okay, but then stuff that really sparkled? What would you say would be the key difference?
I think everybody knows the language in the sense that, you know, when you work with different investigators over the years on cases, I mean, you never meet somebody who says, "Hey, I'm an average investigator," no. Right? Everybody says, I can do this and I can handle it. So everybody says that they're really good and they can handle things. It's just, you just have to sort of work with people and you'll figure out, you know, who is really doing the work, who's making the extra effort to get things done on time. And then, like I said, I think seeing that final written report sometimes can really tell you who's good and who's not. And the other thing, too, is the creativity aspect is overlooked. Like, you always see people or hear people talking about, you know, being very persistent. And, of course, you have to be persistent. That's understood. You can't give up if you're stymied on one avenue. But I think creativity, this is a very creative profession. I mean, a lot of times you'll see somebody who works on a case for a long, long time and they're just sort of spinning their wheels. And then a good investigator will come in and say, "Well, okay, you guys are looking at this as a surveillance case. Why don't you talk to these two people or look at these archives, and you're going to get the answer to your question." And it's, you know, it's resolved in about 2 weeks.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Sometimes it's just that ability to just completely take yourself out and sort of float above the case and then look down on it and say, okay, this is not really that type of case. It's actually this. You can probably get the answer this way. You know, so
a fictional crime writer once wrote in one of his books about how a police officer or a detective is better armed with his imagination than he is sometimes with his gun. And I'm using the male.
I love it.
You know, I'm using the male. So, I mean, at the time he wrote it, that's how he wrote it. So. But an investigator, and I'll do it gender neutral, an investigator is sometimes better off without their gun and better to have their imagination. So
absolutely. That's perfect. Which writer said that?
Lawrence Block. And was in Hope to Die. I actually met, a little aside here, I actually met Mr. Block, Lawrence Block, once. Actually, I met him twice now. Mm. But I met him the first time, and I had printed that off onto an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, and I wanted him to sign that, as opposed to signing the book that I had in my hands. And he said, "Why?" And I said, "Well, I'm a private investigator, and that saying really resonated with me about, you know, the use of your imagination is sometimes more important than having, you know, the tools of your imagination are sometimes better than the tools of your gun." And he looked at me and he thought about it and he said, "Yeah, I was thinking about that when I wrote that and about how an investigator is supposed to, you know, have, you know, more of a imagination in order to solve their cases. Don't you know that a week later, he blogged about meeting with me." And
is that right?
How he said, "Yeah, John Hoda, you know, came to my one of my book signings, and he presented me with an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper with this saying on it, and how it resonated with him being a private investigator, and we formed a a little bit of a a friendship from that." I saw him a couple months ago, and he's up in age now. I saw him a couple months ago at another book signing down in New York, and he remembered me. He remembered that book signing was kind of unique, somebody handing you a framed saying. And
absolutely. Yeah.
And we reunited, reacquainted our friendship again. So I was really happy about that.
I love the quote, and I love that story because, you know, you and I are both not only investigators, but writers. And
right.
I think we've always been intrigued by the intersection of, you know, real investigations and you know, crime fiction and how they were, you know, there is some truth to crime fiction. And then there's, you know, the tropes of the genre too, that people enjoy for entertainment purposes.
Absolutely. So. And, you know, the thing about it is that, I enjoyed reading, through my investigative career, I enjoyed reading detective novels or crime thrillers. And as much to look at the adversity that the fictional detective was going through in their life and how they overcame it and solved the crime. You know, and that to me was always something that was very interesting, and I gravitated towards those writers that wrote that way because it gave me a look at other investigators, although fictional. And the writers did a good job of portraying the difficulties that an investigator would go through in solving a case. So, for sure. Now, since you brought the genie out of the bottle, tell me about your writing, because I mean, I was just so pleased as punch to hear that you had written, and you have something else coming out soon, right? So tell me about both.
I do. So my first crime novel is Telegraph Hill. It's set in San Francisco and involves a woman who's a witness who sort of goes missing. And there's an investigator named Ray Infantino who tracks her down and brings her back into the light. And then I've finished the second book and I'm shopping it, and I've actually started the third one as well. So,
oh really?
You know, I love to write. It calms me down, I guess.
Oh, I understand that.
Hitting the heavy bag at night, but you see things that are frustrating on cases, especially when you do, you know, these wrongful convictions cases, which, you know, my firm does a lot of, and you see, you know, people who have been mistreated and abused in the legal system, and it's just kind of nice to sometimes fictionalize the different aspects of these cases, and it's, I don't know, I need to do it, so I'm doing it.
No, I understand that completely. My writing, I answered the writing muse maybe a few years ago, and my first novel had nothing to do with investigations. It had to do with a Little League baseball coach, and I tell about his story. I love the fact that I can sit down in that fictional world for a couple hours at a sitting and watch my coffee get cold while I just peck away at the keyboard and make up a nice story. And I enjoy it as well. But you did touch on reality, and that is wrongful conviction cases. We both have had those in our bailiwick. Both of us have faced situations where the cops have got it horrendously wrong, or I hate to say it, made it up. And somebody was sitting in jail, forgotten, and it took a dedicated team, you know, usually a couple Davids to go against the Goliath of the state system to spring them. So that's always a good story, and that's one that I'm glad to see that you're fighting the good fight, and that because those people that are in jail for things that they didn't do are the most affected victims of the criminal justice system.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's funny, John, that the wrongful convictions movement kind of gained steam just as I was going out on my own. And one of my earliest cases, it's literally the 11th case that I ever took in. It has that number somewhere in my coding system. I was at an Innocence Project conference, and Barry Scheck and a bunch of other people were there.
Sure.
And they were openly bemoaning how, you know, we don't have any investigators. And I'm sitting in the audience going, you know, I started my firm, or I'm thinking about starting a firm. I think I was still employed by this other company at the time. And, you know, for people who are listening and thinking about, you know, how do you start a business? You know, it's those little moments where you realize, like, okay, This could be something big. Like, you got to kind of gamble. It's like Bitcoin. You know, maybe you should buy some, maybe you shouldn't. But if it's there, maybe, you know, and the price is right, it might be a good purchase. So I remember approaching them, and I say, hey, I'm a private investigator. I'm not a cop. I'm not afraid of working on civil rights cases against police departments because I didn't work for any of them. You know. And they loved it. They were like, hey, you know, we'll set you up with some people here locally. And I ended up taking two cases in immediately. One of them, the Innocence Project in New York, actually took a position and hired me at my, you know, my full rate. And we ended up investigating that case for 2 years and got a multi-million-dollar judgment for two clients against the same police department, same town. So
are you able to talk about it out loud?
Yeah, I was going to tell you a little bit about one of them. Is kind of one of the stories that one of my favorite cases.
Well,
yeah.
roll into it. If this is the time to talk about the favorite case, the floor is yours, senor.
Well, I will tell you, it's probably one of my favorite cases is the case of Dennis Mayer. And Dennis Mayer was a soldier in the Army here in Massachusetts at Fort Devens, and he was convicted of two rapes and an assault, which was likely to be a third rape. And DNA actually exonerated him. And I had just started my company and was contacted by these lawyers who said, you know, we now want to file a civil rights case to get this man some money because he's been cleared completely. And the whole case ended up circling around one witness. So if you can imagine, like, if DNA clears you, right, from a case, clearly they got the wrong guy.
Right.
This one witness had absolutely nailed him to the wall in the trial. And we had, you know, we had the original transcripts. And he gave an ID in the case that was, you know, one of the greatest witness IDs I've ever read, where he, and the witness, his name was Richard Nichols. He claimed that he had walked up to Dennis Mayer, who was repairing his car on the side of the road, and had started a conversation with Mayer, and that Mayer actually gave his name. And the guy remembered Dennis Mayer's name because he had worked for a auto dealership in California by the same name. So if you, and Dennis Mayer always said, he goes, I have no idea who this guy is. I never met him. I never repaired my car on the side of the road that day. So we, you know, we speculated. We said, look, if the DNA has cleared him and Dennis says this is completely fabricated, we're going to assume that that's all true. So where did this guy come from? And so they, the Innocence Project said, you know, can see what you can develop about this guy, you know, Richard Nichols. He was long deceased. And so I had to kind of go back into the 1980s and start a whole story, like, who was this guy? And luckily, during the trial, we had some names of neighbors. And the very first neighbor, I always remember, he lived on a street in Salem. And this was just at the beginning, and I knocked on the door. And I said, hey, I'm looking into this old murder case involving a witness who lived next to you. And I gave the guy's name, Richard Nichols, and he goes, oh, that old con guy? And I said, well, what do you mean? He goes, oh, God, he was a total fraud. So that sort of started the whole trend into, you know, it started the whole investigation into Nichols. And I ended up finding many, many people who would testify that this guy was one of the most unreliable people in that town, that he was known as the town drunk, sad to say. Mm-hmm. We ended up discovering multiple cases where the police had always said that he had just sort of surfaced and he was just an eyewitness, whereas we were able to prove that he was involved in numerous different cases. His mother worked for the police department. All kinds of things that showed that this guy had probably been put up into basically providing that phenomenal eyewitness ID at the trial.
Mm-hmm.
And they never had any report. There was never an interview report that was ever produced. It was just, we only had a notation on a logbook that a police officer had gone and interviewed Richard Nichols, who then, you know, provided all this information that resulted in the conviction. So
yeah,
once I was able to present all that in the Innocence Project, incorporated into a motion that the town ended up settling for quite a chunk of money.
And how many?
So it was
how many years?
A great start.
How many years did Dennis Mayer do before he was?
He did. I believe it's 18 years and 9 months. I believe.
Yeah, and yeah. Never forget the, you know, 18 years, 9 months, so many days and so many minutes, because when you're an innocent person, every minute behind bars is a minute that, out of your life that you never get back. Yeah.
So, absolutely. I mean, you're talking about the core of your life, the time that you meet a woman who maybe is going to become your wife and have a family and start a job. All that stuff was carved out of his life. And one of the most amazing things, too, about him in that case in particular is he has no anger. Well, I don't want to say he manages his anger very well. And he always talks about it. You know, he speaks frequently about being incarcerated among, you know, sexually dangerous predators, because he was a multiple rapist. You know, that's how he was viewed by the state. And I've even met guards and psychologists who treated him in prison. And they've told me, they said, yeah, we always thought there was something different about him. You know, he was calm. He said, I want to work through my rage about being in the system. And they were all told to sort of, you know, the normal thing is you get these guys to admit their guilt and then they can be eligible for parole. And he would always say, I will never, ever admit to something I didn't do. But I do need to learn how to handle my anger, because I shouldn't be here. And they all remembered that.
Almost a, almost a Buddhist equanimity.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
And you know, I think about Nelson Mandela in a hot, cramped cell, and he had one thing to do. He could decide how he was going to deal with it. And I think that sounded like Dennis Mayer.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I know that a lot of the other clients that I've worked with, like Victor Rosario, he spent 35 years in prison. All these guys have that ability to transcend their anger and their frustration somehow. Sometimes they do it through the love of their family, who's constantly visiting them and staying with them. Other times they do it through, you know, religious, spiritual beliefs. Hmm. You have to have something, because a lot of the guys don't do well, you know, when they come out. You know, they do, the rage is too great, you know, and they're angry and bitter. And you can understand why, you know, you can't hold it against them.
For sure. Now, you said it was DNA exonerated him. Did DNA actually show who the real culprit was for the rapes and the assault?
The last time I checked, that's an interesting question, because I interviewed a lot of former cops from the town. It was the town of Ayer. Some of the police officers were defendants, but some were not. So, and some of them were very, very helpful to us. And almost to a man, the ones that did meet with me and were helpful said, "I'm incredibly disturbed by the fact that the DNA kit has never been submitted to get a match." In other words, the town, they just haven't done anything with it. You know, the DNA cleared Dennis, but it was never submitted again to link to anybody, to my knowledge. Maybe that's changed in the very last few years, but that was the state of things.
Do you think you would have caught wind of it again if they did have the kit tested and it showed who the real perp was?
I'm not sure. You know, I don't know if I know that was always our desire, and I don't know how much communication has really gone on, you know, in the last years, because I think everybody has sort of moved on.
Yeah, but you still have victims who,
yes,
who have, besides Dennis being a victim, but you also have victims that don't have justice, and there's the possibility that the real rapist and real assaulter is still out there and possibly doing it to other people as well.
Yeah, and that's one of the things all the cops said. They said, "I can't believe this, that they haven't submitted this for testing, you know, and get it resolved. You know, it might lead to somebody." But at some point, right after we were doing this work, it had never been submitted to my knowledge. So,
and I hate to say it, but sometimes it's the Commonwealth. I know you're up in Massachusetts, so I'll use the Commonwealth. Sometimes it's the Commonwealth saying, "Well, we had the right person," and it's just that the medical evidence or the science doesn't prove it. And even after getting whacked with a civil rights settlement, they still don't look for the true perpetrators of the crime.
Yeah, I know. It's incredible, and it shows, you know, the backlog problems at these labs too, right? That they just can't look at some of these older cases unless you know, you have an active case where you're trying to exonerate your own client. So
that's true. So, but you were able to go back and start to put some flesh and bones on that con man, and were able to show that they, when they needed to have a witness, they dialed up him, and he became the witness du jour. And
he did.
And lo and behold, you know, he either, you know, was a sole eyewitness, or he was the supplemental witness that bolstered the case and caused somebody to either get convicted or plead guilty because, they had this witness, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
No.
And it was, you know, it was fascinating to go back, and we uncovered so much information about this guy. And, you know, we had family members. I even put an ad in the local paper and had, you know, family members calling. Some of them, his family life was very, there were a lot of different branches, and I was getting calls from people who were saying, you know, your investigation is really causing a ruckus because, you know, you're visiting different people and putting pieces together that we didn't even know. You know, we didn't know that these people were related to us, or so. It was fascinating.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun, you know, really an interesting case.
It was, and you got hooked, because I know I'm hooked when I get onto a wrongful conviction exoneration case or a habeas case where Doesn't take long to realize that, geez, things just don't seem to be the way they appear.
Yeah,
and you start
exactly.
You start scratching under the surface a little bit. You do a little bit of digging, and before you know it, yeah, you're onto something. So yeah, for real. So
and the other thing about those cases, John, as I'm sure you know, is it calls into play every skill that you have. It calls for records research. It calls for witness interviews. It calls for genealogical research. Everything, you know.
Absolutely.
So they're sprawling cases, and you know, there's always like an ebb and flow. You know, you might work on it for a year, and then it goes cold for a little while, and then all of a sudden, a little piece of evidence comes up, maybe in some file, and you start pursuing that trail. So they're great cases. I just love working on them.
And to the point of, there is, as much as we love our corporate clients or our trial attorneys, and they do represent some severely injured people or people that need to have justice, there's no one in the justice system that needs more justice than a wrongfully accused and wrongfully convicted individual sitting in jail with no resources other than maybe an innocence project or an attorney that's swamped with too much work anyway. So
yeah.
Is that a good way of saying it? I mean,
I agree 100%.
I do too. And there's a reason why only a few people will take on those kind of cases. And I'm not going to pat myself on the back, but I will pat you on the back, is because you do see that there's a wrong that needs to be righted there. I'm not going to say that you're tilting at windmills, John, but you know, but a little bit of Don Quixote in all of us that want to do right. And that's, I think, you went to law school about the law and about justice. You got into investigations to find the truth. I don't know what case, other than maybe a death penalty case, where whether somebody goes, gets killed because of the accusations the state's making against them. I think that's probably more important than, I know it's more important than a wrongful conviction case. But just the same, to be able to get into those cases, I think they can scare some investigators off, because it really will quickly determine your mettle. And I'm using that not M-A-T-A-L, but M-E-T-T-L-E. And do you really want to expose both your weaknesses and your strengths? Do you really want to expose how much of the...
It's going to call upon everything that you have. You're right. And I think, some things you might realize, like I haven't quite looked at this before, so is it something I can get up to speed on, or can I call in some assistance? And then there's another practical part of it that you and I were talking about before, which is just the part of running a business. So sometimes these cases have been well funded, or I've had a private client that the family has sufficient funds to pay, but a lot of times you are doing it at a very, very reduced rate, or you're doing it on some state grant money, something like that. So you have to have the ability to balance out higher paying cases, your classic business fraud cases, civil litigation that we do a ton of. And then I'm grateful for my early days working in California, because that's part of what we did was these big civil cases, and I have good connections with lawyers here in Boston and around the country and different law firms. So I couldn't do it. I couldn't do a lot of wrongful convictions work if I at least wasn't making up the money on the other end.
It's
just a practical thing. When you run a business, you have to think about those things.
And to your point, I mean, to drill into that even further, I'll even do some metrics with you on that. I look at I don't want to use the word pro bono. I use the word low bono.
Yeah, that's
right. And I look at my low bono work, which is pro bono, essentially. I'm working at many times 20 cents on the dollar of what my normal hourly rate is. And
right.
But I have a business. I can't work those cases day in and day out, because my electric bill, I can't pay 20 cents on the dollar. I can't pay 20 cents a dollar on my mortgage. I can't go into the grocery grocery store and say, look, I'm only going to give you 20% of my grocery bill here. So what I do is I work my tail off on all my regular pay cases, and my low bono cases are extra, but I keep myself to about 40 hours a quarter. So just to give you some round numbers, 40 hours a quarter times four quarters is 160. Well, 160 with about 1,600 billable hours a year, that's like a 10%. And I look at that as like being a 10% tithe, which goes very nicely with some biblical tithing rules of 10%.
You know? I like it. And I like it.
I like it too, because I feel good that I can tithe 10% of my talent. I can, and then, of course, my money is 10% of my treasure. And it's also 10% of my time. So my time, talent, and treasure are all, you know, about 10%. I can do that. And I feel that I have a right livelihood there that I can afford to do that low bono work. And it pays itself in so many other ways. And I think that I'm being tested to my limit on cases that are very, very important. But I think that because I work those kind of cases, other good things come my way. Call it karma, call it what you want to call it. But living a good life and doing the right thing by your clients, I think, always benefits and will be a benefit to you later on. But hey, that's the John Hoda commercial here. So, and John, this is probably the most I've talked on a podcast out of the group that we've had since the beginning. But it's the conversation that two guys have when you get, you know, into the weeds about the reasons why we do this stuff. You know,
yeah, that's right.
And the background for it. So that's a fantastic story. And I'm sure that you have a bunch of other ones. But for right now, I just need to thank you. Like you said, you are working on one novel. You have another one in the hopper. And Telegraph Hill is out there, right?
Yes, it is.
And then Nardizzi and Associates is headquartered up in Boston, working with corporate and business clients and the occasional wrongful conviction case.
That's right. Yep.
All right. So I want to make sure I got that all right. And Telegraph Hill, that's available Amazon?
It's on all the different platforms. Yep. I have two sites. Nardizzi.com is my business site, and then John Nardizzi is my author website. And there'll be more stuff coming on both.
All right. So you wear a trench coat and a fedora on two different websites, then, you know? So that's what I like
to right.
say. All right. Yep. All right. Well, I thank you very much, John. I appreciate this conversation. I hope I didn't blather on too much myself. But
John, it's always great to talk to you, and always appreciate the words that we've had over the years at conferences and whatnot, and it's great to see you continuing on with your work as well.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And who knows? Maybe they'll be testing a rape kit sometime soon up in that neck of the woods. So whatever. So we'll see if...
Don't hold your breath.
I know. But, you know, you can always hope that maybe all those victims can find an answer to what really happened way back when. So
that would be a blessed thing.
All right, John, on that note, I'm just going to say goodbye. I thank you very much and hope to have you on the podcast again some other time.
Great, John. Love to do it.
Okay.
Thanks. Enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening. I hope that I've earned your interest and your time. Please leave any comments on the website, www.johnhoda.com. That's JohnHoda.com. Our guest next week is Catherine Mayer. She's a death penalty mitigation specialist. She explains what that is and how important her findings are in helping a judge or jury decide on handing out a death sentence. This is not the work for the faint of heart. She received a master's in forensic psychology while interning with the Capital Defender of Northern Virginia. She worked as a mitigation specialist with the Public Defender of Miami-Dade's Capital Litigation Unit. In 2012, Catherine established Mayer Consulting, which focused primarily on death penalty mitigation. But over the years, she recognized the need for her to provide a full spectrum of services from fact investigation through sentencing. Catherine's vision was to offer attorneys the benefit of being able to rely on one firm for all their criminal defense needs. Our circle around the campfire continues to grow by leaps and bounds. I thank you for telling your friends and leaving reviews on your favorite podcast app. FYI, each episode takes around 5 hours to research, interview, edit, format, and produce, as well as share. Then there are the expenses to air the shows. I love these podcasts, and your ongoing support is appreciated. You can support the show for less than a couple coffees a month at patreon.com/myfavoritedetectivestories. Patreon is spelled patreon.com/myfavoritedetectivestories, all one word. And you will receive all the stories and just the stories from my guests. But wait, there is more. Each guest has given me a second story exclusively for Patreon subscribers. Help me bring to you my favorite detective stories.